Galena last flooded in 1992 when ice jams formed at Bishop Mountain, about 20 miles downriver, where the Yukon River bends more than 90 degrees. State Emergency Management Officer Mike Bird says this spot is notorious.
You can see that this has happened over eons of time because the Pilot Mountain Slough, Pilot Slough was formed there as a relief valve to that ice jamming process.
Bird says another potential ice jam point is Jimmy Slough, a string of islands located below the Galena Airport. Floodwaters first intrude on residents when it crosses Campion Road and divides Old and Newtown Galena. At higher water, the city siren sounds to alert everyone to move to higher ground. River forecasters say the likelihood of another flood is high this year. Galena City Manager Chal Taylor says residents have to be ready for a flood once the river ice breaks up.
The chance for a bad flood are really high this year. The hydrologists think so, and so do some of our senior residents of Galena think so too. Apparently in places on the river the ice is 6 feet thick, and it's not melting very fast either. We're behind with springtime and breakup too, so it's anybody's guess, but it could happen.
Preparedness Division of Emergency Services spokesman Pat Walsh says is the best way to deal with a potential flood.
What people need to do is if they live in a flood-prone area, is to be aware of changing weather and river conditions, and then to talk to their local emergency managers about official flood warning signals, so they know, you know, if there is a threat, that they're aware of it and they know where to look and how to find out about it.
Local and state officials advise that residents along the river make an evacuation plan. They should stock up on food and water and have sleeping bags and tents ready. For the last 2 years, the Division of Emergency Services has not sanded the river. Sanding acts like a glass cutter and helps the sun melt the ice, a process Bird says works well at Galena.
I definitely think that sanding should happen. By the time that things got around to taking shape in the way that the legislature gets that money out, would have been too late to sand.
But sanding projects have been slashed from the division's budget. The last time the state sanded the Yukon River at Galena was in 1993 at a cost of about $35,000. That was the year after a flood at Galena prompted the state to spend almost $500,000 for disaster assistance. Meteorologists plan to fly the river next week, and once breakup starts, they will watch the ice around the clock, providing continuous updates to residents up and down the river. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
For the third consecutive year, all the spring herring fisheries in Prince William Sound are closed. Between sacrosane, gillnet, herring pound, and spawn on kelp, the fishery once totaled some $20 million. In 1993, the fishery crashed, and about half of the fish that did return were covered with lesions. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game estimates that a few years ago, herring totaled 130,000 metric tons. These days, that number has dropped to 17,000 metric tons in a span of around 3 years. Fish and Game biologist Dan Sharp says scientists are trying to find out why.
There are a host of studies being conducted on herring. There's a genetics study going on. We're doing constant age and size monitoring. We've got two boats out on the sound now, chartered to collect samples.
Those studies are beginning to confirm what fishermen and others have been saying. They blame the herring decline on the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Evelyn Brown is a University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher in Cordova. She says that as time goes by, the evidence grows stronger.
We've made some connections now. We don't have a direct link, but we have some circumstantial evidence for the disease. Noah has done some studies in the lab where they've shown that there's a direct correlation between the amounts of the percentages of fish infected with this virus that affected them in 93 and oil exposure. So there's a lot of evidence now that in 89 we had an outbreak of the disease, and then when those year classes that were affected, the young fish, returned, they were infected with this virus and with a population in not very good shape because of zooplankton in the Sound that a couple of years before, kind of rough oceanic conditions, the whole population was infected and then crashed. That's kind of what we're thinking happened.
Brown says studies this year will tell scientists and fisheries managers more. Meanwhile, Prince William Sound fishermen are looking elsewhere to replace lost income. That means fishing farther from home, turning to black or gray cod, or taking odd jobs. Brown says other businesses that once served a thriving industry also feel the pinch.
That's the other thing, is the town has suffered because the herring fishery a lot of times brings in a lot of crew members and fishermen that have permits from out of town, like Seattle or Anchorage, and those people are not coming to town. That means they aren't buying groceries, and they aren't buying fuel, and they aren't renting hotel rooms or all the other things that trickle off of that.
Brown says there is some room for optimism. She's seeing more juvenile herring this year and more adults spawning, so the fishery may pick up in the future. In Valdez, I'm Shauna Simmons. For the dark months of winter, bird watchers in the Upper Susitna Valley have been restricted to the music of chickadees and common redpolls. Their peeps blend with the quarks and gurgles of the raven like a sonata for triangle and trumpet. The magpie, strutting like a conductor unhappy with his musicians, constantly talks to itself, trying to figure out how to make his symphony complete. But now the summertime orchestra is gathering. A week ago, a pair of swans delivered a deep-voiced honk through the valley. A mallard yeeped, joined in from a nearby pond, and a barrel's golden-eyed duck was seen just settling in. To the delight of the townspeople, the first member of the piccolo section has arrived. "Have you heard?" people say. "There's a greater yellowlegs at Fish Lake." Then add the long, whistling note of the varied thrush. What this musician lacks in variety, it makes up for with gusto. As with the entrance of any well-known musician, the hooded merganser brought wide eyes and hushed tones from the townspeople. Like an audience craning its neck to get a better look, local bird watchers, armed with binoculars, drove to the pullout where the merganser has stopped. It will only stay a week or two, and its low grunts seem to mock the orchestral swell around it. But like any famous name on the playbill, this bird has the audience buzzing. Talkeetnites are showing proper etiquette to the reassembling musicians. People stop in mid-street at each new call. When a swan honks, people rush to their porches to catch sight as the birds fly by. And the drive home now includes a 15-minute stop at one of the many melting lakes to look and listen for the newest arrivals. The orchestra is filling up. The magpie has become nearly silent. Now if we can just get the gulls in the back section to tone it down a bit. Ah well, such is life in nature's orchestra. In Talkeetna, I'm Bonnie Ann Schweitzer.
Heavy metals mostly come from cars, out of exhaust pipes and oil leaks. When snow melt and rain wash off city parking lots and roads, they carry the metals into the waterways. There, they feed the fish and drinking water. The Environmental Protection Agency requires people to keep heavy metals out of water, and State Department of Environmental Conservation engineer Brad Fristo says one way is to divert them into the ground, where they won't circulate.
Once they're stable like that and it's become part of the soil matrix or whatever, you won't have that leaching out. Unless there's heavy erosion or something like that, it won't get carried away.
Another way is to let them run into wetlands. Dave Maddox, a graduate student at UAF's School of Natural Resource Management, has been using heavy metals to water a collection of wetlands plants. He wants to see what they do with lead, cadmium, zinc, and copper.
They're taking the metal out of the water and they're immobilizing it, making it so it's no longer bioavailable, as a buzzword, so other critters can take it up or so it contaminates water that people would drink. I want these plants to remove the metal from the water, period. That's the best scenario.
Maddox is hoping businesses will install wetlands around parking lots and driveways. Fort Knox is putting one in at the gold mine. DOE's Fristo says it will act as a buffer between a tailing impoundment and a freshwater reservoir that's expected to be a prime fishing site.
It's going to just add useful wetlands to the bank of wetlands that we have in the interior. The other thing is it's a safety net in case there is some problem at the site, then any water will filter through those wetlands before it gets to any water bodies that have fish and may be used by the people.
Christo says wetlands can filter more than metal. The community of Wainwright has been running wastewater out into wetlands beyond the village with some success, and in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where 50,000 people visit the Indian Creek Nature Center every year, a constructed wetlands is coping with the crowds. Director Rich Patterson says at first people worried it would freeze up at 30 below, but it seems to make its own heat.
The system is basically a subterranean compost heap, and the bacteria that break down the human waste produce heat as a byproduct. Also, whenever the toilet is flushed or whenever the sink is run, the water that's going down there relatively is very warm.
Patterson says Indian Creek, which mimics a project in Tennessee, has an underground gravel bed, two large basins, and a pond.
Roughly speaking, the first basin has very large aggressive plants in it, cattails mostly and bulrush, that convert an awful lot of this phosphate and nitrogen into plant growth.
The second basin is planted with blooming iris, swamp milkweed, and other colorful flowers.
Those plants also are digesting this sewage. By the time it gets to the end of that, the water is clean, 99% reduction in contaminants, and it flows into a small pond that we've put wetland plants around.
There's no smell, and if there's a downside, Patterson says organic material may build up in the gravel bed over time, in which case Indian Creek would dig it up, wash it out, and put in new rock.
It's taken an area that had no particular interest and made it colorful and rather fascinating, and it's very good for wildlife. We have ducks coming and going from this pond. We have butterflies fluttering around the flowers all summer, and it's really very, very pretty.
When Dave Maddox finishes his heavy metals project at the university, he'll begin a similar set of tests with wastewater. Much like Indian Creek, he says Alaska's small communities may find constructed wetlands a kind of filtering system that suits the people and the land. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
On the surface, the logging at Creamer's Refuge looks a lot like any other operation, till it comes to moving the logs.
Okay. Yep, let's go, Walt. Good boy.
That's John Hogberg and his one-ton horse, Walter.
He is a Percheron, and that's a French horse. And most of these big guys were bred in Northern Europe back in the old days for the knights to ride around on and charge at each other at full speed with big lances made out of hardwood and knock each other off.
These days, Walter's doing battle with birch trees, hauling them out of the woods, working like his grandparents did before tractors took over. Hogberg and his team are clearing land as part of a fish and game habitat enhancement project. Along with his partner Wade, the two horses and Hogberg are keeping alive an old tradition. Don Creamer says horses played a big role on his dad's dairy.
We kept horses up till about 1935, I think it was, or 36, somewhere there. We used them on the drills, the four-horse team, and in the fall and the harvest, you'd use them on the two-horse teams on rakes.
Creamer says even though horses are a good fit for a small job hauling on uneven ground, no one has any illusions of making much money at it. Hogberg spent close to 4 weeks getting about 30 cords of wood, but it gets side benefits as well.
It's fun to watch them work on the varied terrain, to see such a large animal kind of climb up a little embankment and stand there with his front legs way up high and his back legs down in the little gully and see him just push off with both his back legs. It's impressive to me. There's never a dull moment for me watching these guys work. I'm just amazed at the strength they have.
Hogberg picked up horses a couple years ago and has been trying them out on various jobs, mostly sleigh and wagon rides, and he's enjoying this new challenge.
They just seem to get stronger and stronger and stronger, and I don't know when it stops, you know. They seem to run out of traction before they, lose their physical ability to pull something. You know, they're always willing and they keep on trying, and they just could work day after day, it seems. You know, they could work more than I could. You know, I can't keep up with them.
Fish and Game officials chose horses in part because they fit in with the history of the refuge, but also because they're quiet. Refuge coordinator Herb Melchior says the logs had to come out to reduce the fuel load so that when the area is set afire, it won't burn deep into the peat mat.
The real educational opportunity is going to come after the burn, and people can see how the environment reacts to the burn and the flush of nutrients that are released from the burn.
Melchior expects new growth will create habitat for a wide variety of wildlife, including birds and moose. The burning is scheduled for May. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Good boy. Good boy, Walter.
The Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council is asking for proposals to document Columbia's behavior and identify risks the glacier poses to oil tankers. The study will revive and expand programs to monitor the glacier previously funded by USGS. The study will also include a survey of the bottom of the bay in front of the glacier to develop a model for predicting glacial calving. USGS glaciologist Dennis Trabant says surveying the basin in front of the glacier will be key to learning about Columbia's calving rate.
If a good calving relationship is developed, a lot of the glaciological community will welcome that as a very worthwhile addition to our understanding of calving glacier systems. If it's also incorporated into a model, that'll be another major incremental step in our understanding and then predictability of a lot of the calving glacier systems all along the coast of Alaska and throughout the world.
Trabant says since 1983, Columbia Glacier has retreated 6 miles from the moraine where it sat for many decades. He says the chance of icebergs moving beyond the moraine is growing.
The moraine is just loose, gravelly material, and the icebergs are pushed by the tidal action back and forth across that thing, and they gradually give it more seaboard, more free water space over it, so bigger and bigger icebergs are able to leak out.
Calved icebergs often drift into the traffic lanes of Prince William Sound tankers. In 1984, the inbound tanker Overseas Ohio suffered a gash in its bow when it struck a glacier. Tim Plummer, the head of Alyeska's tanker escort and response system, says as far as he knows, that's the only time a tanker has been damaged by ice in the Sound. He says if ice is detected in or near the tanker lanes, special procedures are followed.
The traffic scheme switches to one-way traffic only, and that allows both the outbound lane, the separation zone, and the inbound lane for a tanker to maneuver in. So it gives them a lot more room, to travel through that area in the event that they might experience ice. And the other feature are these ice scout vessels, which is utilizing a vessel to go out in front of the tanker to make sure that the path is clear and that there isn't ice that is present that might create a problem for the tanker.
Plummer says if more ice can be expected out of Columbia Bay, then the RCAC study is more than justified. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
A state game biologist issues his moose call. There are no moose here, but it's got the attention of the hunting students packed into Tananaw Middle School's cafeteria. Some in the audience are new to the state, some to hunting. All have come to learn about taking game in Alaska. Dave Johnson with Fish and Game organized the weekend workshop. He says they started the program 2 years ago to serve a dwindling number of hunters.
What we saw in the early part of the century is steadily increasing hunter numbers. In 1983, however, we saw the beginning of what turned out to be the longest sustained decline in hunter numbers that we've ever seen.
Johnson says the workshop aims to create safer, wiser Alaskan hunters, and a consortium of outdoor groups support the effort. But he admits Fish and Game is also looking after its own. A good portion of the agency's funds come from hunting and fishing licenses, as well as federal taxes on firearms, ammunition, and fishing gear. Fewer hunters mean less money. Johnson says last year hunter numbers started to rebound, and it looks like women may make up the fastest growing segment of new hunters.
We see a tremendous number of women in these clinics, and I say tremendous from the standpoint that 10 years ago we might have seen none. In gatherings of hunters, we would rarely see women. In fact, one of our presenters this morning is an expert bow hunter.
Johnson's talking about Debbie Jepson, who got into hunting by way of target archery, where she holds master standing. Jepson's taken most of Alaska's big game, except grizzlies. For her, bow hunting offers the greatest challenge. You have to get close, she says, and that makes the hunt worthwhile.
I've been wedged between two rocks, and the most pleasure that I've had is not necessarily harvesting that animal, but I've been able to see in its eyes, I've been able to hear it eat, I've been able to look at its mannerisms, and truly understand the animal for what it is. And so the pleasure for me is getting that close. I have to be that close to harvest that animal.
Jepson's views are echoed by many hunters who say they find a deep satisfaction in observing, outthinking, and taking game. Jepson says more women seem to be moving into hunting in part because of this intimate contact with nature. And it's what brought outdoor enthusiast Suzanne Hazeltine to the workshop. She says she's never hunted, but she wonders if it might combine several interests.
I see it as another way of getting out. And I, for my own choices about eating, really appreciate food that's natural, if you will. So what's more natural than a moose or a caribou or fish? And the direct interaction that I have with my sustenance, there's something really pretty neat about that.
If Hazeltine represents an emerging phase of hunting, old-timer Doris Mercer underscores the fact that some women have been hunting for years, in Mercer's case, 15. For her, the pleasure of taking game is putting meat on the table. She came to the workshop to pass on a trick or two.
A lot of these people, too, that don't know how to take and pump up their moose with a tire pump. If they pump their moose with a tire pump, they'll have easier skinning it out. It puts the air between the flesh and the skin, breaks the skin loose from the flesh, also squeezes the blood, pressure squeezes the blood out of the meat into the chest cavity.
Mercer wasn't the only experienced hunter swapping no-nonsense tips, and organizer Dave Johnson says a lot of old-timers show up at the workshops. Still, Fish and Game seems intent in attracting women to the outdoors and catering to this growing constituency. Johnson says last year's weekend clinic acquainting women with the wilderness proved so popular, it'll be repeated this season. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Three things happened when a Superior Court judge ordered the University of Alaska to stop discriminating against unmarried employees and their domestic partners. First, the school appealed the case to the state's high court. Secondly, it temporarily opened benefits to domestic partners. And lastly, legislators sought to change the law. The Supreme Court still ponders the issue, but Monday, Governor Knowles signed a measure which grants all state employers the right to refuse benefits to domestic partners. But the University of Alaska spokesman Bob Miller says the school won't act before the high court renders its judgment.
The arguments were heard in December, and the university will await the court's decision to sort out the legal ramifications that are tied up with the passage of the new law and its effective date.
Miller says the new law affects 44 university employees who signed up for the Domestic Partners Benefit Program. He says the offers nicked the school for around $90,000 out of a total program cost of $18 million. While most of those who signed up for the program are not gay, a few are, including Professor Mark Tumio. Tumio is also one of those who took the school to court in the first place. He says he's disappointed by the new law, and he tends to doubt Governor Tony Knowles when Knowles says it doesn't unfairly target one group.
I think he now has a responsibility to step forward and say discrimination based on marital status is wrong. And especially for same-sex couples who cannot get married, he should come forward and issue an executive order requiring that all state agencies provide domestic partnership benefits at least to same-sex couples. And in this way, he can demonstrate that he is opposed to discrimination.
Tumio says there are lots of good financial reasons for extending benefits to unmarried domestic partners, but he doesn't hold out much hope the university will keep its current program. Attorney Will Schendel, who represents Tumio, says even if the new law undermines some legal foundations, it also paves the way for further court challenges by public employees.
Who are guaranteed by the Alaska Constitution that their employment will be governed by merit system principles. And I think that there's a good argument to make that making compensation and benefits based on marital status doesn't have anything to do with the merit system.
Schendel says even single private sector employees who receive fewer benefits than their married co-workers could claim they've been denied equal protection. Schendel believes the new law won't quell future debate. Meanwhile, both Schendel and the university await the Supreme Court's ruling, expected in a month or two. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Cracks on the along the outside water's edge becoming wider. Sandbar north of runway is 80% covered with water, and travel on the river ice not recommended at this time.
Warnings like this one issued Monday by McGrath meteorologist Tom Edwards often go unheeded. Despite overflow water stretching 75 feet offshore and rotting ice and snow covering the rest of the Kuskokwim, every year travel on the river remains irresistible to a few hardy outdoor enthusiasts in the grip of spring fever. McGrath snow machiner Michael By tells the story. He might not be able to had circumstances been different, of when he and a couple of friends hit the river for a final ride last spring.
It was marginal. We probably shouldn't have been out there in the first place, but just a nice day to go for a ride. We knew it was going to be the last ride of the season, and snow machine bogged down, got stuck. We thought it was an overflow, and the guys came back to help us out, but in reality, I was in an open hole, and the machine stayed up just barely long enough for me to get off of it and get a rope to me and crawl up onto the shelf ice and turn around, and the snow machine was gone. It's literally completely gone. You know, I've lived around here many, many, many years and never had anything at all even close to that happen, and it can happen to any of us. Nobody's completely safe from it.
By says he never attempted to recover the snow machine and is staying off the river this spring. Thicker than normal ice has other risk takers out later than usual this season, but the window is closing. The National Weather Service River Forecast Center is currently predicting breakup on the Kuskokwim sometime between May 5th and the 12th. Upstream at the village of Nikolai, the ice moved out on Tuesday. Flooding due to jamming is still a major threat there and on down the river, where the National Weather Service predicts moderate to severe flood danger. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
Three, two, one. When Valdez City Manager Phil Hubbard was in Juneau last week, he talked with the Knowles administration and legislators about options for keeping Harborview part of the Valley's economy by turning it into a corrections facility. According to Hubbard, the only real option is a 50-bed substance abuse treatment center the Knowles administration proposes.
The other, the privately constructed and operated and financed option, is not really on the table. And so the only real thing you have, the only real option the city has, is to pursue the 50-bed treatment facility with the Division of Corrections.
Hubbard says no one he spoke with in the legislature or administration expressed support for the private medium-security prison. But Allvest Incorporated President Bill Weimar, one of the proposers of the private prison, calls the governor's support an open question. Weimar says the 50-bed state facility is too expensive for the legislature to support, and he remains optimistic about the Corrections Group North plan.
You know, we continue to support this proposal and have every reason to believe that, you know, that we'll be able to move forward with it.
The legislature would have to pass a law allowing long-term financing of private prisons before the plan could move forward. Phil Hubbard says if legislators approve such language, the city would consider a proposal from Corrections Group North later. But Hubbard says the city, which earlier this month supported the private plan, is now vying for the state facility.
When you go after something like this, you have to be fairly focused, and you have to know what it is that's possible, and you have to know what is the likely outcome. And so it looks like that every signal I got pointed to Division of Corrections doing the 50-bed treatment facility here.
Hubbard says if the facility is successful, it could expand considerably since many state prisoners have substance abuse problems. Hubbard says the department plans to open the 50-bed facility July of next year with 35 to 40 employees. That compares to an estimated 100 employees for the private prison, which is the same as current employment by Harborview. The workers came out in support of the private plan, but Harborview Superintendent Pat Londo says the state facility would be better than nothing at all.
Right now, we have nothing. There is no other opportunities or options that are out there.
The number of employees at Harborview is dwindling as the state moves the residents to other homes. Londo says he'll be fortunate to have 60 workers by July of 1997, so a decision from the state is critical to displaced workers deciding whether to stay in Valdez. But a final decision from the state may not come until next legislative session. That's when the legislature would choose whether to set aside operating funds for the Corrections Treatment Center. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
It's not even May, and the Department of Natural Resources in McGrath has already reported the region's first wildfire. Low snowfall totals in some parts of the western interior are making conditions prime for fire earlier than usual this year. Dan Bross reports.
I would encourage.
3, 2, 1. Most likely started by a hunter's cigarette or campfire, the season's first wildfire burned 160 acres of tundra east of the Yukon River, about 15 miles south of the village of Holy Cross, before burning itself out. The Department of Natural Resources out of McGrath didn't take action on the fire because it was burning toward an area with snow cover. DNR area forester Bill Beebe says the wildfire still burned a fair amount of acreage for so early in the season.
That one fire burning 160 acres burned more than we burned all last year. So, you know, we don't know if that's an indication of things to come or what.
Beebe and the DNR deal with a hard-to-predict phenomenon in wildfire. Beebe says the region's low early snows and resultant deep freeze this past winter could make for quick runoff and dry grass this spring.
The thing that we have to consider is that most of the fires in southwest Alaska are lightning-caused fires, so even if we have fuel that's able to be burned, if we don't have the lightning, we won't have fires.
Because of the potential employment they can mean, fires are what many area villagers are hoping for. Emergency firefighting work can be the only chance at earning cash some villagers get. Last summer's particularly slow season left a lot of local pockets empty. The DNR's Beebe says during a big year, his agency has paid out more than $250,000 in emergency firefighter wages. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
The question isn't whether to pay school tax, but how to pay it. Senate Bill 280 would require Alaskans who don't live in organized boroughs to decide whether they want to incorporate. If so, they'll pay borough taxes for education. If not, they'll pay a school tax directly to the state. The committee heard unanimous opposition to the bill from residents who live outside organized boroughs this week. Glenn Murundy chairs a Tok area committee opposed to the bill. Murundy says people don't mind paying their fair share for education, but don't think this bill is the way to do it.
Everybody we talk to likes the old flat school tax. It taxes migrant workers, you know, people who are just here for the money. It's one tax. There's no assessment. There's simple collection. And that's what they really favor here.
Many of the people who testified against also supported an income tax for education. Harry Terman of Copper Center advocates a statewide sales tax.
That way everyone would be paying equally and paying a fair share, and we'd also be getting some tax money out of some additional tax money out of tourists and that sort of thing.
Terman says there's little taxable property in the Copper River Valley, and the state would earn no more than it would spend to assess properties and collect the tax. And Terman wonders if legislators are listening to the testimony. It seems the House State Affairs Committee is. Thursday morning, Committee Chairwoman Jeanette James of North Pole said a lot of changes are needed to make the bill palatable. Other committee members said they support requiring residents to pay education taxes, but want a bill the residents can support. James is planning to raise some different ideas with the bill's sponsor, Senator John Torgerson of Kasiloth, and another State Affairs meeting on Senate Bill 280 is scheduled for Saturday morning. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
Not long ago, reporter Greg Williams was leafing through the Valdez High School yearbook. Like all yearbooks, seniors commented on their hopes and aspirations, enthusiasms and dislikes. As a gay man, Williams says he was startled by the views of two upperclassmen.
Under pet peeve, two of the students listed homosexuals. And it just really irked me when I read that. I was just thinking, you know, how could two students in little old Valdez, where there's not any kind of visible gay community to speak of at all, you know, how could they possibly have a pet peeve being homosexuals? It really made my blood boil.
Williams doubts if school administrators would have allowed the students to list African Americans or Orientals as pet peeves. Further, he says the comments resurrected the loneliness and confusion he experienced in high school.
Another major fear I felt was that people would somehow figure out what I was going through, and then that would just be the end of the world for me, practically. That was how I felt at the time. It's real scary feeling, and again, you're just kind of internalizing a lot of stuff you can't talk. I had the feeling I couldn't talk to people about it, and so I didn't, and that's what it was like. And again, I know that there's got to be kids going through that here.
Before he moved to Valdez, Williams took part in panel discussions to educate students about gay issues and the myths of homosexuality. Valdez High School has a peer counseling program where students mentor fellow students, and Williams invited himself to talk to them. One of those student mentors is Benjamin Reichman, who says at first administrators and most fellow mentors supported the idea. But then parents began complaining to Principal Bob Collins.
Mr. Collins, what he told me is that he had said yes without giving the matter a whole lot of thought. And he thought it over, spoke with the superintendent, Mr. Harry Rogers. And Mr. Collins changed his mind and said that we couldn't have this talk happen with Greg Williams.
Reichman says that decision sparked its own protest, and now the topic is hotly debated in Valdez. Collins and other district administrators declined to talk on tape, but the principal admits he withdrew the offer after hearing the concerns of parents. He says the school now seeks a more objective healthcare professional to speak to students. The issue isn't about Greg Williams's life, he says. It's about wider issues of homosexuality. But not all of the student mentors support the idea of Williams or anyone talking to the school about the topic. Mentor Gemma Kellett.
The issue of dealing with homosexual people should be taught at home, and you grow up with values and morals, and I think having Greg Williams come in would kind of infringe on people's values and morals and beliefs.
Kellett says student mentors already have the skills needed to counsel students, gay or otherwise. But Williams says students need to talk to a person who is gay to understand they are much like anyone else. When the situation is resolved, Williams may speak at the school after all, perhaps along with the healthcare specialist. School Principal Collins says he'll invite someone to talk before the start of the summer vacation. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. Assemblyman Dan Lasota drafted the resolution in response to pamphlets and letters that have targeted Fairbanks' Jewish and African-American populations. Regardless of their situation, he said, no one deserves to be harassed and discriminated against.
The recent mailings in Esther and throughout the state, some of the activities that have occurred in the school, they really need to be denounced. And so that as a cancer, they don't keep growing.
Lasota's resolution called for tolerance of the borough's cultural diversity, but failed to list any group by name. The vagueness prompted this exchange between Assemblyman Ladd McBride and Lasota.
Well, I had a question about what was the definition meant here by diverse.
Diverse, our people are different. It can be you can be different from one another by means of creed, by means of the pigment in your skin, by physical.
But I have certain religious beliefs which would not make me tolerant of some groups. That's why I'm asking for the definition.
Well, it's a good point, and I think it's that you don't have to agree with everybody, but just because they're different from you doesn't mean that you have to harass, act violently toward them, or discriminate against them.
McBride ended up supporting the resolution despite his questions, but dissenting member Bob Logan said he found the resolution inconsistent. He said if the community must tolerate all its groups, it must also be tolerant of bigotry. The resolution sponsor called it a moral issue.
It speaks to more of a moral value. It's the kinds of things that your grandma taught you that you know are right.
The resolution passed 8-2 with Logan and member Larry Hackenmiller voting against. Lesota says although it will be filed like any other piece of paper, he does hope it will be a step towards a more active defense of diversity. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
We expect to be there much the same fashion we have before. However, we won't be expanding beyond anything we've done in the past. We're still pursuing markets even as we speak, and we're hoping to these markets will continue to grow between now and the first day of harvest.
Paul Skvorek's currently on paid leave from the Department of Fish and Game. Last July, the state charged him with 23 ethics violations. Assistant Attorney General Neil Slotnick says Skvorek misused his position with the Commercial Fish Division to enhance his own business ventures.
He had a pattern of intercepting requests that were sent to Fish and Game from the outside for Fish and Game assistance in the area of sonar, hydroacoustics that Mr. Skvorek works in, and that he would answer these requests by saying, no, Department of Fish and Game cannot provide this assistance, but I could provide it through my personal business.
Slotnick's the attorney responsible for the state's Executive Branch Ethics Act. He says Skvorek ran his own consulting business, at times using Fish and Game property and research. Among the 23 counts before the state's personnel board, Skvorek's accused of accepting two contracts with the Canadian government for which he was paid more than $5,000. Under one contract, he consulted with British Columbia in its effort to count fish on the Fraser River. The Fraser is one of the rivers involved in salmon disputes between Alaska and Canada. Skvorek's dealings were exposed when he applied for state and federal grants. In the process, Slotnick says Skvorek's boss was asked to review one grant. In another, Skvorek's business partner asked state legislators for an endorsement. A lawmaker forwarded the request on, and eventually it found its way into the hands of other Fish and Game officials.
The Fish and Game employee who opened it, who looked at this packet, became very concerned because he was being asked to endorse, on behalf of the Department of Fish and Game, a product that could lead to a profit for a Fish and Game employee.
Slotnick spent hundreds of hours over the better part of a year untangling the issue. Eventually, it found its way to the state personnel board. The hearing officer's 68-page report says in several cases, Skvorek lied during testimony. After 2 weeks of hearings in November, the officer recommended the department fire Skvorek and fine him $48,000. After considering the report, the board agreed Skvorek should be fired, but it lowered the fine to $10,000, roughly twice what Skvorek earned from his outside work. For his part, Skvorek maintains he's being persecuted because he's a whistleblower. His lawyer, Jeff Friedman, says the state retaliated after Skvorek went to the Board of Fish, challenging that the state used bad data to get $30 million from the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council.
At that meeting, when his letter hit the board, there was talk immediately of firing Paul Skvorek, and about a week or so later, he got a letter from the AG's office saying that he had committed various ethical infractions.
Further, Friedman says, Alaska law requires Skvorek only notify officials of a potential conflict. Since he received no response, Friedman says Skvorek accepted the work from the Canadians. The issue of filing a disclosure came up in the investigation. The hearing officer says it appears Skvorek actually postdated his disclosure form after the investigation was launched. A final hearing scheduled this week before the department to see whether Skvorek will be fired. Meanwhile, Friedman says Skvorek's appealing and pursuing damages on the whistleblower complaint. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
The important principle is to listen to each other and to be able to keep the their heartbeat going. Once you get that initial momentum established, then you can start looking for the silences.
It's totally biological. It comes from the heartbeat, every function of the system. If you can listen inside your body, it would be moving in certain pulses and rhythms. And, you know, it's the human's chance to fly.
So every second of our life has rhythm in it. And when you look at different time scales, basically, you're looking at the rhythm of seasons, you're looking at the rhythm of your heartbeat. And from the moment you're in the womb, you're listening to this continuous drumming hitting you in a certain period, and it's changing with time.
The human being wants to move to rhythm. It's almost genetic. And that's why you find drums, hand drums, in every culture of the world. You know, in North America, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, because we like to move to music.
It's associated perhaps with language and the way people think. And if you think as rhythm, as a language and a form of expressing yourself, then it's reasonable that each culture will have its own characteristic way of expressing itself at a more visceral level. If you're born into this rhythm, you're hearing this from the moment you're pretty much conceived. Feeling this is around you, people are dancing to it, people are moving to it. And as you grow up, you can't avoid it. It's continuously playing in the background and in the foreground. And so when you grow up, these kinds of rhythms are pretty much burnt into your subconsciousness.
The drummers derive an extreme amount of joy and pleasure and aesthetic satisfaction from the sensations of drumming with their hands and their arms, and you're moving your body and you're doing this in tandem with other people, a community situation, which again is as old as mankind and as old as the whole concept of community. Then we take it a step further and add dancers, which has also been hand in hand through the ages, where they are not themselves playing, but they are responding to these rhythms and to the movements of the drummers.
If Alaskans think their dollar is not putting as much in the tank as it did a few weeks ago, they're right. But those who watch the market in this state say what's lost out of one pocket will end up in another. MAPCO Vice President Jeff Cook calls the return in both tax receipts and revenues positive for government and for people.
The state deficit is reduced as more money comes into the state, and also the money that goes into the permanent fund is a part of non-renewable natural resource revenue increases also.
Cook says Alaskans can look forward to bigger permanent fund checks down the road, and state petroleum economist Chuck Logsdon predicts other long-term benefits.
Higher oil prices mean higher profits for the companies, and also it makes investment in producing future oil in Alaska more attractive. So on balance, we are very highly influenced by the economics of petroleum development and production, and when crude oil prices go up, on balance, Alaska is one part of the world that actually benefits.
According to Logsdon, both national and world markets are driving the rise. Last April, a barrel of Alaska crude was worth $16.50. This April, it brought in about $22. The increase, Logsdon says, was gradual from April to December, but beginning in January, there was a sharp run-up. That's what we're feeling now.
Demand for crude oil due to a very harsh winter in both North America and Europe, along with continued rapid economic growth in the Asia-Pacific market, really caused crude oil demand to outrun supply.
Jeff Cook adds that a general sense that the United Nations would lift its ban on Iraqi oil also kept companies from stockpiling, and now, with Iraq still out of the market and summer on the way, demand is high just when reserves are low. All that, plus the lifting of the export ban, means money for Alaska. Just a few years ago, Cook said there was a $2 to $3 spread between the value of North Slope crude and West Texas Intermediate.
That spread has gapped down to more like a dollar range, so Alaska's crude has become a little more valuable on the world market for a number of reasons, and probably the export ban lifting is being part of that.
While the increasing value of crude means less stress on the state economy, the price of gas still hits the pocketbook. Logsdon says refiners' narrow profit margins mean their costs will inevitably be passed on, and other factors probably mean a long-term increase in the price at the pump.
As long as there is increasing regulation mandating cleaner fuels, those costs, additional refining costs, will have to be borne in part probably by the consumers. So I wouldn't be surprised to see gasoline prices in the very long term trending slightly upward.
California stands as a good example. A gallon of self-serve went up 18 cents there in just the past 2 weeks. California is using gasohol to reduce air pollution. And Cook says because the additive comes from corn, the corn shortage, also due to this year's harsh winter, hit the state hard.
Doesn't matter whether it's from underground or growing in the ground, it seems like the commodities that go into fuel and reformulated gasolines are just rising.
Weather, economies, and stockpiles are all playing their part at the pump. And politics. Just yesterday, two West Coast Democrats called on President Clinton to reinstate the Alaska export ban. Why? To bolster national supply and offset the rising pump prices. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
3-2-1. Borough voters are headed to the polls Tuesday. For the third time in 4 years, they're being asked to approve a school construction bond package. It's priced at $64 million. A state matching grant promises to pay 70% of that. School officials say this may be the last chance to get this state match, and if Fairbanks says no, other districts are ready to say yes. With that in mind, school backers asked Borough Mayor Jim Sampson to craft this latest plan.
We're going to grow here, and we need, that's what the vote is on Tuesday, is, you know, do you believe in the future of Fairbanks? And I think most people see us growing, and our enrollments are growing, our projections are growing, and we need to plan for that, and that's what the debate is on Tuesday.
Previous plans called for building a new high school to alleviate overcrowding. Voters twice rejected the idea, so Sampson crafted a new plan that would instead renovate 7 schools, build a new junior high, and expand West Valley High. But opponents of the bond say borough leaders just don't get it. Voters don't want a bigger high school, and as taxpayers, they don't want to take on more debt. The $64 million, they say, translates over time to $115 million. Nancy Mendenhall says opponents are concerned the plan's driven by the teachers and builders unions, and they want a comprehensive school package that looks to the future.
We're being pushed into building schools because the state may provide 70% of the costs. Is the decision to add 550 students to West Valley and to build a new junior high school a good educational decision, or is it driven by special interest group to further their own financial benefits? This is not a good educational plan.
Mendenhall and others don't trust the legislature to keep its word on the match, and they argue the schools aren't overcrowded, rather the space available is poorly managed. Further, they don't want the proposed junior high built near Danby Road, and they wonder why there's no mention of vocational education or the Hutchison Career Center. Lastly, they reject the all-or-nothing nature of the proposal. Better, they say, to put several options before voters and let residents choose. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Last fall, a gay and lesbian history display at Noel Wien Library prompted an emotional and disruptive debate in Fairbanks. More recently, racial incidents in the schools and hate mail targeting Jews have shown this community where some of its anger and alienation bleed through. Assemblymember Dan Lasota's resolution calls for healing, A community torn apart by divisiveness and polarization, it reads, will never reach its potential. Lasota says the Assembly needs to take a lead in turning things around.
Intolerance and hate are sort of equal opportunity disasters that could happen in a community. I mean, it really knows no bounds. Anywhere where people are different from others, there's always a potential for some people to put them down, discriminate them, even, you know, acts of violence can occur.
Lasota's resolution cites the borough's rich multicultural mix, but isn't specific about race, religion, or sexual orientation. He says people have encouraged him to make the wording stronger, a thing he plans to do at tonight's meeting. Reverend Charles Brown supports Lasota's move. The recent tensions, he says, are not a good sign.
And I think those things indicate a climate in which we can only expect more of the same if we don't really say what our community stands for.
Brown says the community cannot afford to misunderstand tolerance. It can't mean tolerance for bigotry. The well-being of the community, especially a diverse community, he says, demands a higher standard.
We cannot tolerate the erosion of individual rights, nor can we tolerate the incursion into lessening of the individual's responsibility to community. Now, that's where we exercise good citizenship, a consciousness, a sensitivity to the needs of others.
Assemblyman Lasota calls the resolution just a first step in making change.
In and of itself, it's just a piece of paper. It will get filed. But it's a beginning in the fact that we're going to be shedding some light on the issue. People will be given the chance to come forward and speak specifically to this. And just having, I think there is value in having the Assembly come online and, you know, stand one way or the other.
The Fairbanks Assembly meets tonight in Borough Chambers at 6:30. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
The world's salmon supply is flush with fish. Market watchers say that's likely to keep prices low, further squeezing fishers on the lower Yukon River. But processors will be back again this summer. Randy Crawford, co-owner of Boreal Fisheries, says he'll once again be buying fish when the runs begin.
There does appear to be a market for the chums, especially on a fresh basis, and there does appear to be a king market. The king market is a little precarious and a little hidden in some ways, but we're hoping to see some strength, especially in the future years beyond this year.
Crawford says he hopes king prices have bottomed out and doesn't put much stock in predictions of low prices, because he's seen markets turn around quickly. King salmon forecasts peg the run as average. Fish and Game Management biologist Dan Bergstrom expects roughly 100,000 kings to return to the river.
What we were expecting is about an average return of age 6 fish from the 1990 escapements. And although they were pretty large escapements, the indication from last year on the age 5 fish was that we'd probably see an average return.
Bergstrom says summer chum runs should be strong, though markets less so. Last year, buyers paid 20 cents a pound, and some say prices will be lower than that this year. Much depends on run timing and competition from hatchery-produced chum runs in places like Prince William Sound. Looking farther into the summer, management biologist Keith Schultz puts the fall chum run at roughly 630,000 fish.
What that means is if the return as projected, that'd be enough for escapement, subsistence, sport, and personal use fisheries, but it does fall just shy of that level that you would need to provide for commercial fisheries.
But Schultz says a strong return of 4-year-old fish last year indicates his forecast may be light, so he says he's cautiously optimistic about having enough fish to open a commercial season. In addition to market and run information, fishers attending the meeting will also hear from salmon processors and discuss ways for improving quality and reducing production costs. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Particularly in a time when we are having massive cuts from the state and federal government on every turn, and teach in a school where we do not have adequate funding. Highway people now are losing graders because we can't afford them.
You can see the Tococitna Valley. You can see the Tococitna Glacier, and you can see the mountains. The sight is just incredible. I would like to share that with other people. I want to be able to enjoy those things, being just a regular person.
Our school system was designed for an agrarian economy, and in these days of silicon chips, many say public schools work like an old tractor on the information superhighway. The Alaska 2000 education reform legislation of the early 90s was touted as the answer to our antiquated educational system, but lawmakers couldn't pass the package as a whole. Charter schools, though, did get public support. Lawmakers and parents like the idea of exempting experimental schools from many inflexible policies. The state school board approves charter school applications by regions. The legislature has organized the state into 7 rural regions, with 1 charter school allowed in each. 23 charter schools are reserved for the urban school districts. The Galena School District's been planning for the last few years to open a residential boarding school on the abandoned Air Force base here. But with public confidence in boarding schools low, the district jumped on the chance to float a charter school application by the Department of Education. Galena's charter school will focus on teaching rural kids from across the region trades such as auto mechanics and carpentry. Even though the Galena Charter School application has been accepted, Principal Steve Musser says the district isn't in any hurry to enroll students.
I don't want to dive into it helter-skelter and try and open it full force in the fall. I think we'd ruffle too many feathers because people would say, you didn't take the time, and they would be telling the truth.
Musser expects to sign a lease with the Air Force next month, paving the way for local students to begin using those facilities this fall. Enrollment of charter school students from other communities won't begin until the 1997 school year. Musser plans for the Galena Charter School to be available to more than just high school students.
We spent a lot of time this fall dealing with UAF and trying to develop the ability to offer, I call it grades 13 and 14, to local people for additional training. Because right now, when UAF, the Extension Service, wants to offer a class, a lot of times if it's going to be smaller than, say, 6 or 8 people or larger than that, then they fly the people in the Fairbanks, which displaces them from their community and from their home for a longer period of time.
The legislature has not set aside any new funding for the charter schools. Each local school district must provide the startup money. Then the charter school receives money under the same formula as other public schools. Galena plans to begin operating with 50 students, which would mean a state contribution of about $276,000. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
I went to a parochial school, to a Catholic school, and in those days I think we learned through fear. And in this school, I hope the students learn through fun.
That's Takana Principal Bart Mowry. He, his students, and Takotna's less than 20 year-round residents have spent the last 2 years developing a school which frees students and faculty from the traditional educational blueprint. At Takotna, for example, there are classes during the summer. Teachers don't stand in front of those classes, and there are no tests, bells, or books to separate English from science or social studies.
I'm hoping that we don't have classes in the building, that all our classes will be outdoors up until it gets cold. And during those times students are out, they can be collecting data that they would eventually come up and do a write-up on it. We require our students to submit professional-looking paper when they submit them for grade. And they have to write a minimum of 30 pages.
Those 30 pages are later condensed into a short multimedia presentation. Mowry says due to the amount of time and work students can put in, the A, B, or incomplete they receive as a grade is often no surprise to them. This year, 22 students, 20 from Alaska and 2 from Utah, took part in Takotna's program. From Japanese with visiting teacher Keiko Yamabe to salmon biology with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the emphasis is learning by doing, a notion key to another facet of the school, in which students and community members focus on vocational pursuits.
What I'm kind of looking at and envisioning the school to be doing is to become an agent of change for community and rural development. Many of our communities or the villages don't have economic base for which they can sustain themselves. And So I wrote a grant in cooperation with the Tacana Community Association. Now, it's a project that we're starting in the school. We're building some caskets, and hopefully we can market them. And if it is successful, then we'll turn it over to the community.
Principal Mowry partially credits the transition from alternative school to the more accepted charter school designation with helping Tacana to secure grant funding and other support for its programs. Recently, the school received $30,000 for its salmon counting and study project from the Bering Sea Fishermen's Association. Such success has Mowry thinking big. He says the school's diverse program is attracting a similar student body and faculty, and that with new housing, the school could achieve its maximum of 40 students within the next couple of years. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
Millions of birds are making their annual migration north from winter homes to their summer breeding grounds. They come from as far south as Chile and stop over many places. But around the 1st of May, the birds reach one of the most important points on their journey, the Copper River Delta, with its 75 miles of mudflats stretching out into Prince William Sound. Between the populous western sandpipers and Pacific dunlins, whimbrels, yellowlegs, dowitchers, and dozens of other species, the birds sometimes number a million birds at once on the Copper River Delta. As Marianne Bishop of the Copper River Delta Institute explains,
it's quite a sight that all of these thousands of birds that are so focused on feeding, you can get very close to watch them. And then, of course, you know, when they pick up and move in the flocks, that's probably the most impressive thing.
Bishop says that while other shorebird festivals attract more people, the Copper River Delta Shorebird Festival boasts the most birds.
The Copper River Delta is, I would say, the premier stopover point. There's no comparable place in Alaska to the Copper River. And I tell people the Copper River Shorebird Festival is for the serious birder. I mean, if you want to see birds, this is the place to come.
Started 7 years ago by the Forest Service, Prince William Sound Community College, and the Prince William Sound Science Center, the Copper River Shorebird Festival has grown larger every year. The festival has also been recognized as a successful partnership between business, government, and education. Kelly Grobe is executive director of the Cordova Chamber of Commerce.
We were one of the 12 sites selected by a commission put together by President Clinton's administration to go out and view how tourism in communities through government partnerships are working. This is a great example of how three entities are working together to create awareness for a critical habitat that is so important to the economies in a community. The fishing industry and other industries rely so heavily on the Copper River Delta and the habitat that is lives there.
Still in a town fearful of the negative aspects tourism can bring, the Shorebird Festival is widely supported around town. Grobe says there are two reasons for that. First, the community likes the range of family activities and the festival's emphasis on education and awareness. Also because, for the most part, Shorebird Festival participants are aware and concerned about habitat protection.
The community as a whole buys into the festival because these people are not going to be the average stereotypical tourist that every community fears that someday there's going to be T-shirt stands everywhere.
For now, Cordova's motels and restaurants are full of people, and the Copper River Delta is full of birds. In Valdez, I'm Shauna Simmons.
Every year, about 40,000 babies are born with birth defects caused because the mother drank during pregnancy. Psychologist Barbara Morse with the Fetal Alcohol Program at Boston University Hospital says no matter what the extent of damage, affected children learn much more slowly.
They have perceptual problems. They have severe learning disabilities. A whole cluster of symptoms that tell us that something has affected their brain's ability to function the way we would expect it to.
Morse says when a pregnant woman drinks, alcohol passes to the fetus through the placenta. Heavy or binge drinking means more alcohol gets to the fetus. But because not all alcoholic mothers produce children with defects, researcher David Gilliam has been trying to determine which mothers do. His experiments with mice have shown that mothers with a genetic sensitivity to alcohol most frequently produce impaired offspring.
Both morphologically, in other words, the babies are smaller, and behaviorally, they don't perform as well in learning tasks. So there are learning deficits in these alcohol-sensitive offspring that were prenatally alcohol-exposed.
The next step, Gilliam says, is to identify the gene that makes the difference.
And once we start answering that question about what genes are responsible, we can start seeing, well, what is alcohol doing to these genes? Can we prevent it? Can we identify people at risk? It's going to open up a whole new avenue of intervention, I think.
The next step is a big one, requiring a crucial combination of funding, time, and the right scientific questions. But Gilliam, who works with the University of Northern Colorado and was lecturing in Fairbanks last week, says it may not be long. Knowing what causes defects will help researchers and the public know if and when drinking during pregnancy can ever be safe, and when and for whom it is the most dangerous. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
It doesn't take long to peg Andy Jack for a leader. Just a handshake will do. But if that's not enough, take a look at her schedule. For the next year as Miss Indian World, she'll be out of town every other weekend and expects to travel some 75,000 miles.
I'll be really making some adaptions here. I know it can be done, and I'm just going to look at this whole year of travel as new life experience and, you know, something to help me break out of my comfort zone.
After just returning from Albuquerque, she's next off to Mexico for a cruise, then to Ohio for a major powwow, down to Nashville for the Grand Ole Opry, and up to New York for an appearance on the Today Show. But like any role model, the job comes with plenty of work. Jack says one of the toughest parts will be acting as a role model all the time, everywhere she goes. It's a lot of responsibility.
There are a lot of people watching you. Maybe some young kid, if they see you having a cocktail or having beer, that say, oh, Miss Indian World does it, so therefore it must be okay. And you never know how you're guiding these young people through your actions. You know, they could pick up on that. And ultimately, when you're in a position of responsibility, it's just that, you know, you never know who you're responsible for.
Jack was selected during the Gathering of Nations powwow in Albuquerque 2 weeks ago. She wore a traditional Yupik squirrel parka, danced, and explained the story behind her Jivuk boots. She was chosen from a group of 26 and says the award came naturally.
I just kind of leave it in the hands of the judges, in the hands of the creator. You know, I think everything happens for a reason. There's a reason why somebody wins a title. Maybe they're meant to represent the people.
Jack's won other awards as well, including Miss Kuskokwim, Miss Fairbanks Native Association, and Miss World Eskimo Indian Olympics. She's currently studying education at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and works summers as a guide on the riverboat Discovery. It takes confidence, she says, but she wants young people to know that they too can succeed.
It's kind of like Eleanor Roosevelt said, nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent. And with these pageants, as with any public speaking or anything that you go into, first of all, you have to want it bad enough. Then you have to have the heart, the right frame of heart and mind for it.
Miss Indian World 1996, Andy Jack. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.